This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a new report shows that white people support draconian punishment and huge prisons because they blame black people for crime. Another step forward in the long battle to free U.S. political prisoners. And how has the uprising in Ferguson, Missouri, changed the black struggle in the United States?
But first, thousands of fast food workers in 150 cities went on strike last week, demanding $15 an hour and union representation. The strike was backed by the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union. 500 workers were arrested, including Daria Cephas, a McDonald's employee from Boston and an organizer for the fast food campaign.
The show was real great. Actually, we had a lot of people come down to show our support. We had 8 people just sitting down on the middle of the street, stopping traffic. Organizers, community workers, community people, people from our community, other workers is there. So we had a lot of support.
How hard was it, or was it easy, to get your fellow coworkers to go along with this strike action?
The thing I tell people is when you go on strike, it's something you have to do for yourself. It's really not something that someone can tell you and make you do. It's something you have to say that you're frustrated and you're tired of the way the workers treat you and you're tired of the way your bosses treat you and you're tired of getting paid $8, $7, $8, $9. You're tired of that. And you feel as though you deserve more. So that's the way I get my support from my workers, my coworkers, and other people, is the fact that we tell them our story, that we're all fed up and we're all tired of the same thing.
What kind of community organizations turned out in support for you guys?
We have Mass United, SCIU, City Light, ministers from different churches. It was just a lot of people. It's just hard to keep tabs. I'm really not too sure exactly how many organizations were there. But we had a lot of support, which is what I've always told people. I really do appreciate it.
What was the reaction of management on the job? How did management react to your strike action?
No manager wants their workers not there. No manager wants to sit here and walk around with their head cut off trying to figure out who to put where to go where. So we disturbed a lot of stores and we disturbed a lot of work because some people, we were on strike, so people didn't show up for work that whole day. So no matter if you had to work at 4 o'clock or if you had to work at 10 in the morning, no matter what we did, everyone stayed out of work. Everybody did not go to work that day. Managers was calling phones and finding out why people didn't show up. They told them we were going to strike and they couldn't do nothing about it. All they can do is just wait for the next day.
You also want union representation. How does management respond to that?
Some managers are against it sometimes and other managers are with us 100%. Like, some managers want us to get a union, want us to get 15, and those managers, at the same time, they're tired of the same things. And some store managers refuse to pay that because the store owners refuse to pay it, and it's just all a whole bunch of other nonsense. You just don't want to mix everything up. And like I said, some managers give us their full support in everything we do, and they say, yeah, get the 15, we need 15, all of that's important.
Right. At McDonald's, some people who are called managers don't really get paid much either, do they?
Yeah, no, they don't.
McDonald's has been claiming that, and I'm talking about McDonald's that's headquartered in Oak Park, Illinois, has been claiming that it has nothing to do with how the different stores are run, although a court ruled differently.
McDonald's headquarters is responsible for the pay rates. They can say if they wanted to go up. They can say if they wanted to stay. They have all say in that. They refuse for it to go up because they don't want to cut into their profits. So right there, they are responsible. And there was a case in Chicago. There's judges and labor board proved that they are responsible for pay wages. They're responsible for their companies and what their companies do to pay rates. So if they say McDonald's is getting $15 an hour, every worker is getting $15 starting tomorrow, no franchise owners can say, no, you can't do it. The corporation has all say it at all times.
If a vote were held today at the restaurant that you work at for union representation, how many of your fellow employees would vote for a union?
if the union was set up and everything was going 110%, everybody I know would be a part of it, because the simple fact is that it's important to a lot of workers that we all stand together and we all fight for the same cause, versus all fighting our own single battles when we're stronger together.
And the Service Employees International Union has been backing the strike. I would assume that you'd be affiliated with that union.
I'm part of the fast food campaign. Really, that's the only union I'm really a part of. All the rest of the union, we love their support. We support them when they go on their strikes and do what they're supposed to do. But it's really our focus. It's fast food workers and fast food across the world and across the nation. We had 150 cities going on strike that same day yesterday. And it shows how strong and how powerful our voices are. The fact that the media and everybody else is trying to find out what's going on and how much y'all getting paid and how do y'all live off that. And people raising children off $8. And it's ridiculous. So it's a lot of things and a lot of work that goes behind it. But I'm mainly, my whole focus and my whole concern is the fast food campaign. So I'm not really sure about the other ones.
In Boston, how many restaurant workers were represented in the strike? Workers from how many restaurants?
It was Popeyes, Dunkin' Donuts, Wendy's, Burger King, McDonald's, pretty much all the major fast food chains was there, pretty much. We had workers from every major fast food chain that's in Boston that we can get our hands on. And that came on down and showed their support and said that they want to. So I say all the major fast food vendors, really.
And what's the next step?
It's just to grow stronger and continue our fight for 15 and hopefully get corporations and finally, you know, agree and say, yes, they deserve it. They put in the hard work. We can afford it. It's not as difficult. So until they see eye to eye with us, we're going to just keep growing stronger and stronger and stronger. We tried striking. We tried protesting. We wanted to show fast food companies as clear as possible that we are here and we are not going away until they raise the pay and let us form a union without retaliations. And we're going to fight for 15 and inspire thousands of workers across the country and the world to join us every day. So it's going to get stronger and stronger. That's all we're going to do. All we have is our voice and our feet, and we're going to let everybody be heard. We're going to march across the nation and get it done.
That was Daria Cephas in Boston. This fall, the fast food campaign will travel to 12 countries on 5 continents to talk to fast food workers around the world.
Hundreds of black activists from all across the United States traveled to Ferguson, Missouri last month to join in protests against the police killing of Michael Brown. Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network was among those who made the pilgrimage. Dix is busy preparing for a month of activities to resist mass incarceration in October. We asked him what has changed in Black America since Michael Brown was shot down.
Well, there's two ways to go at that. The first is that the events in Ferguson have changed a whole lot. They have changed the way that people all across the country look at mass incarceration, police terror, and the criminalization of black youth. They've got people talking about that. They've got people who have suffered that, feeling that they can stand up and speak about it. And they've opened the eyes of many people who were previously unaware that it went on and put that truth before them. So that part of things has been changed. But then at the same time, things haven't changed because the cop who killed Michael Brown is still on paid vacation, just like the cop who murdered Eric Garner up here in New York, and killer cops all across the country, because dozens of black and Latino people have been killed by cops since the murder of Michael Brown. And this needs to stop. So that part of things hasn't changed, and it needs to be changed. And in fact, it's something that we're working on an approach to changing.
There's been some effort to focus on the particular conditions in Ferguson, the fact that it's 2/3 black, but has only a handful of black cops and one black city council person, as if that is the root of the problem with the police.
Yeah, that's a very important point that you bring out, because there are apartheid-like conditions in Ferguson which need to be looked at and ended, but let's not be fooled into thinking that those will end police terror, will end mass incarceration, will end the criminalization of our youth. Because, you know, New York City has a fairly diverse police force, and cops here brutalize and murder Black and Latino people with impunity and are never punished, because we're dealing with something that is frankly built into the fabric of this capitalist system. You know, this system really has no future for millions and millions of Black and Latino youth in the inner cities. And their approach to that is not to figure out how can we provide meaningful employment that will allow people to survive and raise families. How can we retool the educational system to incorporate people into the economy? It is how can we suppress and control people.
What kind of activities are we going to see in October?
Well, October is going to be a month from beginning to end of mass determined resistance to mass incarceration, police terror, and the criminalization of the youth. A key part of it and a key nodal point is going to be the October 22nd National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. And on that day, in cities across the country, thousands and thousands of people are going to take to the streets in coordinated nationwide demonstrations, saying no more to the brutality and the murder that law enforcement is unleashed to inflict, especially on Black and brown communities. That's a key nodal point. But the month is going to start out with sermons in churches, mosques, and even synagogues, exposing the horrors of police terror and mass incarceration, and encouraging the congregants to be a part of the activities throughout the month in resistance to that. There are going to be panels and symposiums on college campuses, and there are going to be cultural events, and people are going to be wearing orange in solidarity with the movement to stop mass incarceration. In other words, there's going to be a broad array of activities. There are going to be diverse groupings of people involved, people motivated by their religious beliefs, young people who are tired of being treated like criminals, college students who see the injustice of this and feel like earlier generations of college students, that they have to put themselves on the side of justice, as well as revolutionaries like myself.
You spent about a week and a half in Ferguson. What was the level of political organization and political consciousness among the young people there?
Well, let me start with the consciousness level. People in Ferguson were very determined that murders like that of Michael Brown had to stop. They were just very, very clear on that. And you saw that in the way that they came into the streets night after night in the face of everything the police could throw at them, in the face of attempts to divide them. They put out a Black state police chief to put an officer-friendly face on this, to get people to stop coming out. They mobilized the National Guard, set curfews. None of that stopped people from coming out. And people even said when they got some Black peacekeepers to work to keep the protest calm and peaceful, even though the violence was actually coming from the police, not from the protesters. But when they put these Black peacekeepers out there, they were telling, especially the young people, it's time to go home. We've made our point. The curfew's coming up. You should go home. And people said, Michael Brown cannot go home, so we're not going home. They said, all right, well, you've been protesting all day. It's time to go home and get some rest, and then we can come out tomorrow morning and protest, which would have been after the curfew was over. People said, Michael Brown cannot get rest, so we're not going home and getting rest. We're staying in the streets till we get justice. So on the consciousness point, there is a broad understanding that people need to fight for justice around Michael Brown and other victims of brutal murdering police. The level of organization is a different kind of question, because there's a question of organization around what to do what. And one very big question is how to look at the federal government, because they actually have had some impact creating a feeling that, well, the local officials may not be reliable when we're talking about justice, but Eric Holder, He's experienced racial profiling, and maybe we can count on him to bring the Department of Justice in and get us some justice. And that has been a dance that the feds have done in order to cool out people who are enraged at police murder and police brutality and the failure of local authorities to do anything about it. And historically, the Department of Justice has almost always also failed to do something about it. So on that point, things need to be further gone into and further struggled around. You know, and there is organization developing, including some new organization. But like I said, some of the questions like how to look at the Department of Justice, how to respond to this thing of, well, the protests have to be calm and peaceful, when actually all of the violence has really been coming from the police, are important questions that people have to dig into and break through on.
Yes, if there had been calm and peace, nobody would know the name of Ferguson.
Neither would they know the name of Michael Brown. And that's something that people down there are aware of. And on one level, they're very proud that their actions have reached not only the whole country, but around the world. Because I was paying attention to Twitter. People from Gaza were tweeting to people from Ferguson when the tear gas was being deployed by the police there with guidance on how you can deal with tear gas, because they felt like there was a synergy between the struggles in the two places. And then the other thing is people were very welcoming of the fact that people came from around the country, because when I went to Ferguson, some of my comrades had gotten there before me, and they were wearing a T-shirt that was BA Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. I had on the same T-shirt, and the first day I get there, people were coming up to me on the street and hugging me because they knew I was with the people who had stood with them the night before in the face of tear gas and rubber bullets. You know, and then when I got arrested for refusing to back down in the face of curfews and National Guard mobilizations, when I got into the prison, the brothers and sisters in the jail were like, you were one of those people that came down here to join the protests. And they wanted to thank me. They wanted to hug me. And then I had to say to them, well, first, I got to thank you all, because if you all hadn't stood up first, I wouldn't even have known about this. So I couldn't even have come.
And tell us how people can get involved in next month's resistance to mass incarceration.
Yes, to get involved in the October month of resistance to mass incarceration, police terror, and the criminalization of a generation, people can go to the website stopmassincarceration.net. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word, no punctuation, .net.
Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, speaking from New York.
In Washington, the Sentencing Project has released a new report titled Race and Punishment: Racial Perceptions of Crime and Support for Punitive Policies. In short, the report concludes that white people support harsh penalties for crimes because they associate criminality with black people. Nasgul Ganush is a co-author.
I put this report together really thinking a lot about what happened after Oscar Grant's death, after Trayvon Martin's death. And so those incidents were really fresh in my mind. And just in the final moments of preparing it before its release, we had the shooting of Michael Brown. And again, that illustrated all of these questions about what's going on. Why is it that we see these incidents where police officers and regular civilians who are armed are, you know, in these very suspicious situations shooting unarmed African Americans? And so this report, I think, sheds some light on that. But it also tries to show that it's actually a much bigger issue at play here. So what's happening is, in, you know, we're not sure yet what happened with Michael Brown's death, but we know that there are really important questions that need to be asked and answered. And we also know that without the incomplete picture, white Americans and people of color tend to kind of go in very different directions as far as what their expectations are in these circumstances. And even when the issue is resolved, so for example, when we had the verdict with George Zimmerman, when you had the verdict on Rodney King going back that far, people have very different reactions in terms of whether they think that justice was served or not. So part of that has to do with perceptions of the criminal justice system and how fair and just it is. And another part of it has to do with perceptions of who commits crime in this country and how much criminality we associate with people of color versus with whites. And I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that.
Well, what kind of methodology did you bring to bear in addressing these questions?
I really tried to provide as comprehensive an account as possible on research that's been conducted by academic organizations, by nonprofit organizations, by government agencies that looked at several different areas related to this question of, do whites tend to overestimate how much crime is committed by people of color, or just do they tend to associate people of color with criminality, and what are the consequences of that? So some of this research asks white Americans very directly, so how much crime, how much robbery, how much burglary do you think is committed by whites versus by African Americans? And when researchers did this, they found that whites had an exaggerated assessment of how much these crimes were committed by African Americans. What they did there was they compared what they learned in their surveys to actual arrest data, and they found that there was about a 20 to 30% overestimation for a lot of violent crimes and juvenile crimes, when whites, overestimation in the sense of whites attributed a higher proportion to African Americans than was actually the case based on arrest data. There's also psychological research that's been done through controlled laboratory experiments where, and this is implicit bias research that asks people, shows them images, for example, a black face and a white face, shows them a kind of blurry image of something that is either a weapon or it's a tool. And people are asked to quickly identify what they're looking at. And what these studies do is they look at when a person is shown a white face versus a black face, does that distort their impression of what they're seeing? And they find that it does actually quite a bit, that whites tend to mistakenly identify something that's not a gun as a gun when they're first shown a black face versus a white face. They also take longer to correctly identify tools as tools, for example, when they're shown a black face. So these studies measure both accuracy and speed, and they're able to show that there's this implicit bias in a lot of the reasoning that people are using in order to go through these experiments. And then the third area of research is just looking at what the actual work of both criminal justice organizations and lawmakers, what policies do we have, what kinds of decisions are prosecutors making and judges. When you control for differences between whites and non-whites, differences even including class, differences including the severity of their offense, criminal history, there's been research that shows that whites get a better deal when they go through the criminal justice system for the exact same crime as what people of color have committed. So that's another area of research that I looked at, in addition to media. How does the media portray criminal defendants and suspects, and what kind of racial disparities are there in that setting?
I guess there is a real difference here, certainly in social impact, between a white sales clerk who looks at a black person in the store and sees someone casing the joint and looks at a white person in the store and sees a customer. There's a difference between that and a policeman or a prosecutor who's not supposed to be imagining crimes. They're supposed to be gathering evidence of actual crimes.
Exactly. And the conclusions that I was able to draw in this report, based on the survey of research, is that a lot of times this kind of bias, so many people have it. A majority of whites have it. A substantial portion of even African Americans and people of color have this kind of bias as well. So famously, you know, years ago, Reverend Jesse Jackson talked about, and there have been many other examples of this, of when seeing an African American young man walking down the street, of being a little bit more nervous than if the person was white. So it's not just whites, but importantly, it's also not just whites that are sort of traditional, just racist. These are people who subscribe to ideas of racial equality and tolerance, but these ideas are so ingrained in our culture that we can't help it. I mean, I can even think of examples of myself doing this. There's a car rental company behind my house, and routinely I see whites going up to this car that's there. It's a sort of a car that they use a card to access and rent. I see whites using that system, and I think, oh, those people are going to rent a car. When I see, you know, one time I caught myself that there was a young couple, African-American couple, and I looked and I thought, well, why are they back there? And I realized they're back there doing the same thing that everybody else does there that I never think twice about. And, you know, the racial difference made it so that suddenly I became more suspicious, right? So I wrote this report. I'm someone who's really conscious about these things. I really want to try to weed racial inequality out of the criminal justice system and all parts of society. But my goal here is not to say, to just cast blame to some fringe segment of our population, but to suggest that we all have this. We all use these kind of heuristics in our thinking, and unless we admit to them and consciously monitor their consequences, then they're just going to go unchecked.
These kinds of subjective perceptions are not limited to whites, but they are rooted in a culture of white supremacy.
That's right. That's right. And so they come from our media representations of crime and justice are just saturated with images of this report. You know, there's been a lot of studies that look at in specific jurisdictions, like in Los Angeles or other cities, what proportion of the suspects that are shown or written about are white or black or Latino relative to the proportion that are reported as committing crimes in arrest records. And a lot of times there are racial disparities. There's an emphasis on people of color. There's also another kind of bias that researchers have shown in that a disproportionate amount of the crimes that are shown are ones where the suspect is a person of color and the victim is white. And so this creates this impression that the whites are really likely to fall prey to crimes committed by people of color, and that's not the case. Most crime is intraracial, so it's black against black or white against white. But yet there's this distortion that happens that when we translate what's actually happening in the world to what we're seeing in the media, and that has a big impact. And so this impact is something that's really important. The impact is not just that criminal justice professionals disproportionately target people of color or give them a worse deal as they go through the criminal justice system. This is true. This is part of it. But another consequence of it is that the research that I highlight in this report, and that's really sort of the center of this report, is that the more whites associate crime with people of color, the more supportive they are of punitive policies in general for everybody. So this doesn't even just impact people of color going through the criminal justice system. This affects even whites going through the justice system because as a consequence of these subjective perceptions, we have greater support among whites for the death penalty. We have greater support among whites for mandatory minimum sentences, for three strikes laws, all kinds of punitive policies that don't just affect people of color. They disproportionately affect people of color, but they actually contribute overall to the excessive punishment that we have in this country for everybody.
That is white supremacist culture being translated into law.
That's right. What we see is that these kinds of racial associations of crime, they affect our entire society and they affect all parts of our criminal justice system. So they affect public sentiment, and we know that judges and prosecutors are responsive to what the public wants in terms of the degree of harshness in sentencing. It then goes on to affect the work of criminal justice practitioners and lawmakers. And so we have famously the incident where George Bush Sr., you know, during his campaign against Dukakis, really highlighted the case of Willie Horton, who was an African-American man that committed terrible crimes against white victims and really helped with his election. And there have been many other instances where policymakers are using crime and politicizing crime and race in a sort of implicit, subtle way in order to further their campaigns and developing policies around these ideas. And then they also affect the work, as I mentioned earlier, of criminal justice practitioners, prosecutors, judges, but even public defenders. So there's research showing that in the way that the limited time that public defenders have and what they decide to, how they triage, racial biases affect how they do their work. So if they tend to think that Black defendants are more likely to be guilty, they'll dedicate a little bit less time to those cases than to white defendants that they have more empathy for. And so again, what's really interesting here is this is a population within the criminal justice system that is there to help people and that often has a, you know, racial analysis and wants to help people of color and recognizes the disparate impact that African Americans and Latinos are experiencing. But these things are just unconscious, subtle, and, you know, unless we really monitor them and acknowledge them, they affect all of our work. There's also been research that shows that jurors, they've done this with mock juries where they've been able to show that there's some impact on the decisions of juries based on the race of the defendant. There's not nearly enough to address, but there have been some efforts. So in North Carolina, there was a law that was passed in order to make sure that there was greater diversity in the jury pool, because this is something that helps a lot. So making sure that there are people of color in the jury pool does a lot to make jurors more conscious about race and potential bias, and this helps a lot to deliver more fair outcomes, and it prolongs the time that jurors deliberate. That's one effect that's been found, and it makes it less likely, for example, in death penalty cases, that a jury will decide to impose the death penalty on a defendant. Unfortunately, that law was overturned in North Carolina. But, you know, around the country, there are some judges that are trying to implement similar kinds of practices to make jurors aware of these issues. And what's promising is that we know in many cases, once people are made aware of their biased behavior, and once they realize that their behavior actually contradicts the principles that they subscribe to and are hoping to advance, it motivates them to change their behavior. And so there's definitely room for optimism. But the first important step is to recognize and admit that we're not colorblind in our decision-making, contrary to what we might hope. Even those of us who really are actively trying to pursue racial justice, when you actually look at our work, a lot of times, either, you know, especially among criminal justice professionals, either just because of individual discretion or organizational policy, we're not treating people fairly, regardless of their race.
Your study and others like it would seem to bolster those who say that the Black mass incarceration regime that we've had with us for at least 40 years is the product not of increases of crime or based in realities, but a punitive response on the part of white people who imagine that Black folks present such a great danger to their safety.
That's exactly right. One thing I would clarify about that, so first there's been research that's shown that, for example, since 1980, from 1980 till 2010 was when a really big bulk of the growth in the prison population has happened, and every year in that period, the prison population grew. But crime rates went up and down during that time, so it's not the case that a crime spike during that entire time from 1980 to 2010 would account for why we have such a large prison population. So instead, what accounts for it is more people were being sent to prison, and they were being sent there for longer periods of time. And so with the first example, clearly with drug crimes illustrate this, that drug offenses and drug laws illustrate this best, and that we didn't have, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, we weren't sending a lot of people to prison because of drug use and drug sales, whereas we started to do this with the war on drugs. And the war on drugs, even though we know from research, for example, conducted by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, that whites, African Americans, Latinos use drugs at similar rates. For some categories, whites even use drugs at greater rates. We even know, in addition to that, that people generally buy drugs from somebody of the same race and ethnicity as them. So if drug laws were being fairly enforced, then the population in the prison system for drug law violations would represent the general population. That would mean they would be mostly white. But that's not the case at all. It's completely reversed, and most of the people that are punished for drug law offenses are people of color. So that's one area of completely unwarranted disparity that's a result of policy rather than crime rates. But when it comes to serious violent crimes, we do see a racial disparity in who's committing these crimes. And that has a lot to do with broader inequalities beyond the criminal justice system. So when you look at our cities and when you look at urban poverty, most people living in those conditions are people of color. And as a consequence of that, the rates of violence that we see, especially serious violence, for example, homicides, nearly half of homicides are committed by people of color. And again, as I mentioned earlier, most of these crimes are intraracial, so the victims are also people of color. And that has to do with broader economic, racial inequality in our society. So that's something to address the disparities in our prison system. For those kinds of crimes, we need to look beyond the criminal justice system to address the broader racial and class inequalities in our society that are fueling those kinds of disparities in actual crime rates.
So how do you fix a system that is so deeply flawed by race?
At the end of our report, we describe interventions that have been put into place in jurisdictions around the country to try to undo some of these effects, to try to bring these disparities, for example, in media coverage to the attention of reporters so that they can audit and correct disparities in the way that they're reporting on crime. Interventions for policymakers so that they're more conscious of the policies that they're producing, especially during this era now where we have lower crime rates. We're a little bit more conscious about the disparities in the drug war. There's growing interest, especially in decriminalizing or legalizing marijuana. So to use the current climate to bring about reforms. And so especially at the state level, we've been seeing this happen. So since 2010, the prison population has been decreasing every year. This is really promising. It's been happening at a really slow rate. So we did an analysis that it would take something like 87 years to get back to 1980s level of incarceration at the current rate that it's been changing. So hopefully we can build on this momentum and increase it and at the same time be aware of racial disparities that remain in the system. So a couple of states around the country have passed racial impact statement legislation, which encourages legislators to do an analysis when they're changing criminal code to check whether there's a disparate racial impact that would result from the bill that they're considering. So that's in Oregon, Connecticut, a couple other states are working also on that legislation. There are programs in place where prosecutors' offices and other criminal justice practitioners are beginning to analyze their work and see whether there are racial disparities in outcomes and try to figure out what the root of that is. And some of this work has been done best in juvenile justice area. There's been a dramatic reduction in the number of juveniles that are in confinement. So that's definitely a victory and you know, could hopefully get brought over into the adult justice area as well. And, you know, in terms of addressing implicit bias, there have been a number of efforts to look at both individual discretion and try to root out bias in individual discretion, and that happens partly by just bringing bias to people's attention. Increasing diversity in staff and in settings will help a lot, and also to weed out bias in organizational policies. And so there are a number of instances where, for example, looking at school zone drug laws, which enhance penalties if someone is caught with drugs in a school zone, well, this has a very disparate impact so that people in urban areas are much more likely to find themselves in a school zone with drugs than people that live out in the suburbs. And, of course, we know about the racial and class disparities there. And so some jurisdictions, so Connecticut, for example, Massachusetts, have reformed those laws given what they found about has a disparate impact on people of color. So there are a number of policies and reforms that we've seen around the country. We just need a lot more of them, and we need a lot more of them to be implemented sooner.
That was Nazgul Ghanouch, the Sentencing Project in Washington.
Afia Wangaza is director of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination and WMXP Community Radio Station in Greenville, South Carolina. Wangaza is also an international human rights advocate and recently returned from Geneva, Switzerland, where, with the help of the Jericho Movement, she represented U.S. political prisoners before a panel of the United Nations. The UN requires that the United States report 5 years from now on the status of those still held in prison from the civil rights and COINTELPRO era. We asked Wangaza what exactly that means.
It means a couple of things. First of all, it implies and indeed recognizes the existence of political prisoners in the United States, which the United States, like all governments, deny exist. The fact that the committee asked that the United States report on their status as opposed to asking if they existed, if they held any, implies that it's believed that the United States, like all other governments, does in fact hold political prisoners, and what is happening with those political prisoners, what are the conditions of confinement, why are they being confined, why has the United States not brought to bear some kind of what are called exceptional or special measures to resolve the status of persons from the civil rights era in light of the fact that the United States claims that the issues addressed by the civil rights legislation being broadly celebrated these days resolve the questions for which these persons were active. And if that is true, then the United States, like South Africa and other celebrated countries, has a duty to resolve the status of the persons who were active around those issues. I guess the parallel would be in a shooting war where you have prisoners of war. When the war is over, then the prisoners are released and returned to their home countries and whatever other requirements are necessary in order to reinstate them into society. So the United States has to answer that question to the global human rights community as represented by not just the Third Committee, but the Human Rights Council, of which the United States is a member. The importance of this particular reference is that it is the third out of three reviews in which I've appeared on behalf of COINTELPRO civil rights era political prisoners, political activists, and human rights defenders, wherein we have been able to build from the first, which was in November of 2010, before the council under the Universal Periodic Review, which reviews, it's a peer review process where one country or all of the countries review one country or review each other. And at that point, Cuba and Venezuela raised the Cuban Five, of course, but also raised the existence of political prisoners and fortified our prior efforts to make the question a part of the official UN record when they said to the U.S. delegation, in order to be in compliance with UN obligations across the board, it would have to release all political prisoners and Leonard Peltier and Mumia Abu-Jamal. From that point forward, we were then able to obtain language calling for civil rights era prisoners, and with a specific reference to Herman Wallace and the use of solitary confinement, which of course after 15 days and went indefinite beyond that is defined as torture, then we were able to establish in addition to the existence, a time frame and a specific set of prisoners. Then with the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, we have been able to more firmly not only establish the existence of political prisoners, but what political prisoners and now the United States has to answer. Now, it can continue to ignore and not respond. However, it will be a question that will be raised at every review. It can also strengthen the hand of any claimant that makes a call on the United States, challenges the United States for failing to answer. And whenever a complaint is ultimately filed with the Inter-American Court, of which the United States is a party, then all of this language can be raised. And it is then that the United States has to answer in a court of law, a court of international law. So we've been building a record which strengthens the case for the release of political prisoners that we expect to at some point be resolved. It also strengthens us in our call for the formation of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
It must be said that when the next review takes place 5 years from now, many more of the 60s and 1970s political prisoners will be dead.
That's the hope of the U.S. government, certainly of the Fraternal Order of Police, the FBI, CIA, and other law enforcement formations. However, we are not waiting and relying on that occasion. There are other kinds of activities that are going on behalf of political prisoners, individually and collectively, in the interim. For instance, I will be going to Geneva in November to argue on their behalf around the Convention Against Torture, Inhuman and Degrading Treatment. Torture, isolation, or solitary confinement being a common condition of incarceration for political prisoners. Cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment is reflected in medical neglect. So those kinds of issues are still being raised. Then in the spring, we will complete the campaign that began, that's been going on for the past 4 and then 5 years, using all of the various treaty reviews as a way of putting and keeping U.S. political prisoners, COINTELPRO, civil rights era, political activists and human rights defenders on the global human rights agenda and holding the United States accountable there for the retention and conditions under which they are being held. But other activities are going on as we speak to break the grip and to result in their all ultimately being unconditionally released from the simplest traditional kinds of clemency petitions to compassionate release to various forms of litigation theories that even at this late date we'll come up with an attempt to apply. So we know that the international arena can be, along with other activity, an effective mechanism. We need a stronger ground game, as they say. We need people in this country, especially those who have benefited from the struggle that was escalated as a result of political prisoners' activities, to step forward and to speak up on their behalf, to put pressure on the Congressional Black Caucus and other elected officials, including Obama, to release them. There are the recent mechanisms, clemency for people, so-called nonviolent drug offender program. It's been suggested that that also be tested as an exit. So there are a number of mechanisms and a number of activities that are in place, but as we all know, without the outrage of the people, then they will, in fact, more of them will, in fact, wither away and die. And as long as there's breath in my body, I won't be silent about it, and I won't allow others to be comfortable in the silence about it.
This committee, the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, has also had something to say about the Michael Brown shooting and U.S. Stand Your Ground laws.
Michael Brown's name just rippled throughout the UN the whole week that we were there. There wasn't a moment when there wasn't a question about Ferguson and why the tanks were brought out for peaceful protesters, or even for protesters who might have been reappropriating material goods or expressing their anger by setting a fire to property. The standard still being that life is more important than property, despite the fact that the United States has a problem keeping that in order. But I'll have to say to you that the most poignant moment was when one of the experts asked the head of the U.S. delegation what happened to the man who killed Trayvon Martin. And it was just, the silence was resounding. That epitomized the view of the world towards the United States, that African people, young African males in particular, could be shot down in the street on their way home by whites with impunity. Trayvon Martin and Mike Brown became the international face of racialized violence, the return of lynching in the United States. And the committees, although it called for the United States to take actions to reduce the number of guns, to pass legislation to ensure that the Stand Your Ground laws did not undermine and circumvent the traditional principle of self-defense, there was an air of exasperation that the United States is in a state of uproar. In fact, I think that the reference in this morning's Washington Post that Ferguson was a reflection of white rage against Africans as opposed to an African rebellion against white police terror. And I think that there's something to be said from looking at it from that perspective, and that is how the committee saw it, that whites in the United States are just totally beyond the pale, and that the government is incapable of reining them in.
Another example of white rage are the Stand Your Ground laws, which the UN committee had something to say about.
The Stand Your Ground laws were, to an expert, characterized as an effort to circumvent the traditional self-defense laws and a way out for whites venting their hostility, their racism towards black people and other people of color.
Now, of course, the committee doesn't have teeth to punish the United States for allowing white rage to express itself with deadly effect in the United States, but it does cause the U.S. some embarrassment in the international arena.
It causes the United States great embarrassment. I would urge people to think back over the years where that embarrassment has caused the United States to make various concessions, most notably the various so-called civil rights laws, voting rights, public accommodation, school desegregation, which actually came as a way of quieting things at home so as to deprive various, as they thought, enemies, Soviet Union, Cuba, critics, silencing various critics. So it has that power. It also deprives the United States of the finger-wagging standard presentation of itself as the gold standard for human rights defender and practitioner. It gives some moral authority to other countries. One of the members of the committee was a Chinese professor whose primary focus was education. And he made two interesting points. He spoke to the closure of public schools across the U.S., but in Chicago in particular, and raised the question as to whether or not it was becoming illegal for inner city youth to be educated. And he said to the United States in the future that it should list the denial of public education to African American children among its own human rights violations, as it presumes to do an annual report on the human rights status of countries around the world. So it's a pretty powerful tool, depending on what the agenda is. And I think that while it has its weaknesses, it has also its strengths, and we should not abandon any tool or any forum where we can make ourselves heard.
Yes, it seems at least on that committee, there are more probing discussions of issues such as race and education than we usually hear in the United States.
Absolutely. Well, the third treaty is actually called the Race Treaty because the focus of it is on race and how a country is dealing with the issue of race. So we were greatly rewarded in many ways as a result of our being there and being able to take advantage of it.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It is the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. And while you are there, make plans to attend Black Agenda Report's 8th year anniversary celebration at the historic Riverside Church in New York City on October 24th. I'm Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, especially our engineer, Martin Enwaga. This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.